With the writer whom I have just quoted, let me advise my readers to practice examination of conscience. This exercise seems difficult to some Christians. When we urge them to adopt it, they exclaim, "What are you proposing? A Chinese puzzle? Do you ask us to remember all we have done in the course of a day? Do you ask us to review all the thoughts which have passed through our minds from the rising of the sun to its setting? All the sentiments of affection or hatred, and all the movements of sadness or joy which have arisen in our souls? How can you ever expect us to do all this?" To these words we must respond. Please do not exaggerate. You know full well that you are not asked to review the entire day in every detail. There are 1,000 thoughts, 1,000 sentiments, 1,000 products of your interior activities which have left no trace on the memory and which it would only fatigue you to recall. Examination of conscience consists not so much in the perception of details as in a general review. There's no need of examining successively each one of the actions with which the day is filled. Do you wish me to draw up for you a few questions which, save for slight variations, will serve you in making a good examination of conscience? First, have I observed the rule for a pious life which I have drawn up for myself? Second, have I kept up the struggle against that particular fault which I propose to correct? Third, have I acquitted myself conscientiously of that duty of state which I have a tendency to neglect? Now, my daughters, is there one among you who cannot give 5 minutes every day to the consideration of these questions? Who then will longer strive to screen her laziness behind a faulty memory or a want of time? Many persons are astonished when they are told that an examination of conscience can last 10 minutes or more. What can we do in this time, they ask? We can discover what sins we have committed during the day in 2 or 3 minutes. These people are mistaken in the purpose of the examination of conscience. They imagine that it ought consist merely in searching out faults. This is an error. The examination of conscience ought to be a halting place in our lives, during which time the soul should hold the most intimate intercourse with God. Here is a method for an examination of conscience drawn up by St. Ignatius. 1. Begin by thanking God. Why thank Him? Because remembrance of the benefits which God has heaped upon us gives us a better idea of our ingratitude toward Him. Fix your attention each day on one of the general benefits of God. Creation, conservation, the incarnation, the redemption, the Eucharist, and the happiness of heaven. Finally, call to mind some one particular benefit of the present day. 2. Ask God for the grace to know yourselves well and to judge yourselves in the same light in which He judges you. 3. Examine yourselves on the particular fault which you have determined to correct. If you wish, you may think upon the means for acquiring some virtue. 4. Ask pardon of God for your dominant fault and ask Him to strengthen in you the hatred of venial sin and the resolution to avoid all imperfection. In other words, ask your divine Lord to grant you grace to cooperate generously with His inspirations. 5. Impose a penance on yourselves for the negligences which this examination has revealed to you. 5 or 7 minutes will suffice for all this. My daughters, do you desire to make your examination of conscience easier and more fruitful? Force yourself, then, in the last moments of your examination, to foresee the diverse circumstances which will arise during the day. Seek out what temptations or difficulties you must face. Then arm yourself by prevision against the attacks which you are likely to encounter, and take refuge in the resolution to wage a good fight for God. We do not take care to foresee the attacks, nor to fortify our weak points. This is why the enemy slips into our fortifications so easily. We fall most often by surprise. We know that from experience. The examination of conscience, when conducted with foresight, will fortify us against surprises and baffle the ruses of the demon. As soon as anyone puts this counsel into practice with perseverance, it is easily perceived how quickly her venial sins and involuntary imperfections diminish. Her habitual somnolence and dangerous improvidence cease to become the accomplices of temptation, and her supernatural life, disentangled from the 1,000 meshes which fetter it, soars rapidly upward. Chapter 7. The Art of Rising After We Fall. Very many of us do not know how to rise up again when we have fallen. Yet this art of rising after a fall has a very important place in the spiritual life. It is a guarantee of perseverance for those who are masters of it. What is perseverance, my daughters? Does it mean that we never fall? No, indeed. It is the rising again as soon as we have fallen. It is the attempt to march onward towards the goal without losing any time in lamenting our falls. Here's the history of many among you, my daughters. After a retreat or an unusually good confession, you've set out with a quick step full of confidence and whispered to yourselves, "At such a pace, I shall cover a great distance." But at the very first obstacle, at the moment when you least expected it, you have fallen flat to the earth. Instead of rising at once, as your good sense prompted you to do, you have remained fixed to the earth, plunged into discouragement, and have not dared to turn your face towards God. Here you are, for the moment, numbered among the helpless people who imagine that they can never take up the march again. Let us try to find out the secret reasons for this condition. At first sight, this self-distrust takes on the guise of humility, but in reality, it is only the counterfeit of this virtue. Justly does St. Francis de Sales ridicule those who desire to be as impeccable as the angels, and who are not far from believing that they can attain that end. When these people, awakening from their dream, find themselves with their faces to the earth, they are utterly at a loss to comprehend their situation. They become vexed with themselves and immediately give up the struggle. "These emotions," says Père Gru, "are the effects of self-love, more pernicious than the fall itself. We are astonished when we have fallen. This is a grave error. It is a sign that we do not know ourselves. We ought to be surprised not to have fallen more often and into graver faults. Oh, how troubled we are when we fall into some fault. We lose all our interior peace and become entirely discouraged. This discouragement lasts for hours, for days even, and in some cases become fixed. It is one of the effects of self-love, that is all." From his Manual De Om Interiores, Chapter 20. What an injury is done to God by this discouragement! What a want of knowledge of the heart of Christ is shown by the mournful and despairing attitude of those who, after committing perhaps a light fault, dare not look either towards heaven or the tabernacle. Nothing offends Jesus more than this ignorance of his tenderness towards sinners. Let us consider the rules laid down by the saints in regard to this deplorable state. They bid us commence with a resolution to struggle valiantly and to keep in mind our weakness. They would have us foresee all the faults that we shall probably commit in the course of our progress. Our program of action must be clearly laid out for the moment when a fall may occur. Perhaps it has occurred. We have fallen. What do we propose to do? Let us remember the words of St. Paul. "With those who love God, all things tend towards good, even sin." Are you aware that evil often tends to augment divine grace in the soul? This is true, however. Your own personal experience attests to it. St. Francis de Sales indicates a practical means for profiting by one of our falls. "Believe me, Philothea," writes this admirable saint, "as the mild and affectionate reproofs of a father have far greater power to reclaim his child than rage and passion, so when we have committed any fault, if we reprehend our heart with mild and calm remonstrances, having more compassion for it than passion against it, sweetly encouraging it to amendment, the repentance it shall conceive by this means will sink much deeper and penetrate it more effectually than a fretful, injurious, and strong repentance. If, for example, I had formed a strong resolution not to yield to the sin of vanity, and yet had fallen into it, I should not reprove my heart after this manner: 'Art thou not wretched and abominable, that after so many resolutions hast suffered thyself to be thus carried away by vanity? Die with shame. Lift up no more thine eyes to heaven, blind, impudent traitor that thou art, a rebel to thy God.' But I should say compassionately, 'Alas, my poor heart, behold, we are fallen into the pit we had so firmly resolved to avoid. Well, let us rise again, let us call upon the mercy of God, and hope that he will assist us to be more constant for the time to come, and let us enter again the path of humility. Let us take courage, and from this day onward be more carefully upon our guard. God will help us, we shall do better.' And on this reprehension I would build a firm and constant resolution never more to relapse into this fault, using the proper means to avoid it, by the advice of my director." Remember how infinite is the tenderness of Jesus towards sinners. Instead of regarding him as a severe judge, regard him rather as a father, whose arms are stretched out to draw you to his heart. If your fault is grave, hasten to seek absolution from the priest. If it is but light, remember that a confident look towards Jesus will amend for it. Say to him, "Pardon me, O my God." Then take up the march again without losing a moment in bewailing your fall. Listen to these words of Pierre de la Colombier, who was an eminent master in the spiritual life, and who, as you know, was the director of the Blessed Margaret Mary. His words seem like an echo from the Sacred Heart of Jesus. "If I were in your place," he wrote to a friend who was very much troubled over a fall, "I would console myself in this wise. I should say confidently to God, 'Lord, behold a person who is in this world to exercise thine admirable mercy. Other people glorify thee by showing forth the powers of thy grace, and by thy fidelity and constancy I will glorify thee by making known how great is thy mercy towards sinners, and how thy mercy exalts itself above all malice. I shall prove that thy mercy can never be exhausted, and that no relapse, however disgraceful and criminal it may be, can lead me to despair of it. I have offended thee deeply, O my loving Redeemer, but my offense would be still greater were I to commit the horrible outrage of imagining that thou art not merciful enough to forgive me. The demon may cause me to lose everything else, but he can never rob me of the hope in thy mercy. Though I fall 100 times, and though my crimes be 1,000 times more horrible than they are, yet will I hope in thy mercy." After addressing our Lord thus, I would commence to serve him with more fervor than ever before, and with the same tranquillity as if I had never offended him. Letter 89. Let us now take the case of one who makes use of the method just indicated, but who never attains any appreciable results. Some slight fault, from which she has striven to free herself, and which she imagines she has reduced in some measure, suddenly springs up again. She begins to believe that she is no farther advanced than when she began. Will she, for this reason, doubt the mercy of God, the efficacy of prayer, and the reality of the efforts she has made? If so, she will err vehemently. God has excellent reasons for leaving her in her spiritual infirmities. When God thus confronts her with failure, when he permits her to break resolutions which she's made 100 times, he shows more mercy than if he accorded her impeccability. This poor woman must be cured of her foolish pride, otherwise she will never attain to intimate union with God. Now then, when God permits her to fall into these miserable temptations, he disillusions her mind and makes her realize her interior misery. He cures her of this swelling of pride by a treatment which, though very painful, has a sovereign efficacy. A holy sister of the Order of the Visitation writes, "Though you might deplore the ravages which a great flood had caused, would you not rejoice if it had left on your land some excellent stones which you could use for the foundation of a superb palace?" Now humility is the foundation of the spiritual edifice, and God, who is its builder, can never erect it until we have hollowed out for him a great excavation by a true knowledge of ourselves. Sister Cordelette. Let us listen to this dialogue of a saint with a person whom he was directing. "I tell you that you will be faithful if you are humble." "But shall I be humble?" "Yes, if you will to be humble." "But I will it." "Then you are humble." "But I know I am not." "Then I am sure that you are, for that is a sure sign of humility." Letter to a Superior of the Carmelites. My daughters, 2 resolutions should result from our little study. First, resolve to practice, after each one of your falls, this prompt and confident rising again which I have described to you. Secondly, resolve that instead of being vexed with yourselves when your efforts to triumph over a fault have been unsuccessful, and instead of losing fault, you will renew the struggle, more distrustful of yourselves and more confident in the heart of Jesus. Chapter 8, The Interior Life. The interior life, these are the words which the fervent among you understand, but which means nothing or have a dreaded sense to the lukewarm. Now, if I were to tell you that the interior life consists simply in placing yourselves under the eye of God each day and living in his presence, you would no longer misunderstand the title of this chapter, nor have visions of those moral tortures which are in use in the most austere monasteries. Well, the interior life is nothing more than the exercise of the presence of God. St. Francis de Sales calls this exercise the most efficacious means for procuring the spiritual advancement of the soul. Consequently, it is the most efficacious means for combating lukewarmness in all its forms. You should read in the Introduction to a Devout Life the two chapters, Part 2, Chapters 12 and 13, which St. Francis de Sales has consecrated to this subject. In his graceful and attractive style, he describes this exercise of the presence of God, and though his analysis is very complete, he does not exaggerate the difficulties of the exercise. He contents himself with celebrating its advantages and promises agreeable surprises to those who decide to practice it. But St. Francis de Sales was addressing a fervent woman who loved to retire within herself, seek God in and around her. She was one who could keep silence and yet speak 1,000 affectionate words. Now it may happen that I am dealing with a lukewarm woman. I must then fit this method of St. Francis to her spiritual state. I shall say to this lukewarm woman, "You find it difficult, you tell me, to place yourself in the presence of God every day. You complain of having no attraction for this practice. You perform it without any joy or enthusiasm. You are tempted to lay down your arms and imagine that this interior life was never intended for you. Do not yield to this temptation, I pray you. Approach near to God by your will, by duty, not by inclination." In certain attacks of sickness, we have no appetite. The very sight of food gives us nausea. Nevertheless, the doctor commands us to eat. We yield to his command through a sense of duty. First we eat to be obedient. Then, little by little, the appetite returns and we eat because we are hungry. This same thing often happens in the spiritual life. You must place yourself under the eye of God every day out of obedience to your spiritual doctor. You must make aspirations even though they seem cold to you. Put all your good will into them and you will soon awake from your torpor. You will begin to feel an attraction for this kind of prayer. I even dare to predict that the exercise of the presence of God will become, sooner than you think, an imperious need and a very sweet habit. Moreover, suppose that you should have to perform this exercise without relish all during life. Suppose that you should be obliged to constrain the will in order to lead it to God. What difference would it make? Many holy persons are obliged to exercise this same violence over themselves. To many, prayer brings neither joy nor consolation. God subjects them to this trial, but it never prevents them from being very dear to the heart of Jesus. Let us not forget that true fervor and true love of God reside especially in the will. Let us not forget that a prayer in which we have felt no sensible attraction may nevertheless be an excellent prayer. If we've made a valiant struggle against distractions and placed ourselves under the eye of God. In one word, let us not forget that unlike human love, the love of God has no need of being felt. Let us remember that it resides especially in a firm purpose of adhering to God, of giving Him a large share in our lives, and of accomplishing in everything His thrice holy will. The conclusion is that in our attempts to approach nearer to God and to keep ourselves within His presence, we must not be discouraged if we feel no agreeable emotions, nor think that we have lost our time if we express our love, or rather our desire to love, in terms which appear cold and even rude. These attempts at intimate conversation with God are not at all unsuccessful. They are extremely profitable. There are several ways equally good of placing ourselves in the presence of God. First, with the eye of faith, we can see God in everything. Yes, this great God everywhere envelops us with His presence. He is in the air we breathe. He is in the grain of sand which we tread underfoot. Hence the words of St. Paul, "In Him we live and move and have our being." Do you desire to seek God in yourselves? You will find Him present in your heart. This is by no means an idle fancy, for the heart, if it is adorned with sanctifying grace, is the temple of the triune God, and a sanctuary in which you can always enter into communion with the three adorable persons of the Holy Trinity. Do not imagine God present in the heart as on a throne receiving the homage of his vassals. Though this idea may be exact, it paints but one aspect of the reality. Imagine God present in you as a friend receiving hospitality and profuse with his gifts. Do you often think of God hidden in our tabernacles? This is an excellent thought for interior contemplation. What matters the distance which separates you from Jesus? Does not his infinitely penetrating eye pierce the walls that intervene between you and him? In reality, you are continuously living under the eye of Jesus. When you converse with Jesus as if you were before the tabernacle, you are practicing interior contemplation under a strictly theological and very consoling form. Let me close this chapter by a counsel borrowed from an excellent spiritual author. Do not despise exterior means. To kneel, to regard a pious image, to kiss the crucifix frequently and tenderly, to pray with the hands folded, to turn towards a church where Jesus is present in the sacred host. All these actions have their influence on the senses and arouse holy emotions. Do not impose on yourselves any penance that is too difficult, for you will soon abandon it. But take care not to reject, under this pretext, every penance that is irksome. Remember that a sick person sometimes has to make an effort even to breathe. Chapter 9. The Government of the Tongue. No one has described better than the Apostle St. James how great a power the tongue has for good or evil in our spiritual life. Quote, "If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man. He is able also with a bridle to turn about the whole body. For if we put bits into the mouths of horses, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also ships, whereas they are great, and are driven by strong winds, yet they are turned about by a small helm, whithersoever the force of the governor willeth. Even so the tongue is indeed a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold how small a fire kindleth a great wood. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is placed among our members, which defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the wheel of our nativity, being set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast, and of bird, and of serpent, and of the rest is tamed, and hath been tamed by man. But the tongue no man can tame, a restless evil, full of deadly poison. By it we bless God and the Father, and by it we curse men, who are made after the likeness of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so." St. James chapter 3, verse 2-10. Which of the two, man or woman, guards the tongue better and suffers less from a prurience to speak? This is an odious question which I shall not venture to answer. I shall leave it to those moralists who are more solicitous to give point to an epigram than to observe facts. It is relatively easy to ridicule woman's excessive desire to speak and her horror of silence, but a man who might have at his service the wit of Rabelais or the cunning humor of La Fontaine would not be a fair judge in a debate of this kind. Therefore, the simplest way out of the difficulty is to confess that this prurience to talk is a defect of human nature and a temptation which all of us, men and women alike, must vigorously combat. What is the aim of that woman who gives herself up to continual babbling? Her aim, of course, is to shine among her acquaintances, to win their esteem and to compel their admiration. But she often finds that she has attained a result diametrically opposed to that which she sought. If she is wise, she can often read on the faces of her listeners those words which were uttered in the time of Cicero, "Empty barrels make the most noise." She seeks to please those with whom she converses, and lo, she wearies and fatigues them. Quote, "If babblers suffered as much as they make others suffer," says one of the ancients, "they would soon be cured of their excessive desire to speak." Unquote. My daughters, here is a just duty which is incumbent upon you. You must keep a severe guard over your conversation. Now, your principal aim, I take it, is not to have yourselves reputed as persons of fine style and agreeable intercourse. You are Christians, hence you regard the opinion of God 1,000 times more than that of the world. Therefore you will pay more attention to arguments of the supernatural order than to worldly arguments. I conjure to you to exercise a severe vigilance over your words, because according to the teaching of Holy Scripture, sin is always accompanied by an unbridled loquacity and useless babbling. My daughters, you know from experience that all conversation in which you have not guarded the tongue was a source of remorse to you. You know well that from such and such a visit, during which you have yielded to your excessive desire to gossip, you have come away with a troubled conscience. The question arose in your mind and demanded an answer. Was the fault that I committed grave? Now this question did not always proceed from an exaggerated delicacy of conscience. It was the expression of a well-founded fear of having fallen into mortal sin. Be on your guard, my daughters. You are on dangerous ground when you give expression to every thought that passes through your mind. You must take counsel from God and say to Him, "Have I the right to say this?" If you are not extremely watchful, you will fall before you know it and unwittingly exceed the limit which separates venial from mortal sin. Let me give you the teaching of Catholic theology on this matter. Every slander is grave when it is of such a nature as to cause serious injury to your neighbor's reputation. It is not necessary to know the gravity of the slander by searching out what damage it has actually caused to your neighbor. It is sufficient to ask yourself this question: was this slander of such a nature as to injure my neighbor? If it was not, there is venial sin. If it was, the sin is mortal. To know why this teaching of Catholic theology is so severe, let us invert the order. Suppose you have been slandered. Oh, then, what a clamor you make! All vengeance, divine and human united, cannot weigh too heavily upon the impudent wretch who has dared to sully your reputation. Judge then the value that your neighbor attaches to her reputation, and conclude that God is right in becoming the defender of the absent against the wickedness of the slanderer. It is useless to affirm to yourselves or your friends, with your eyes raised towards heaven, that you have the purest of intentions. This fashion of stabbing your neighbor for the greater glory of God is disgusting. It cannot be too deeply branded. I know of no more repugnant spectacle than that of a person who makes a profession of piety and then tears her neighbor's reputation to pieces. But how shall we brand the act of that person who communicates frequently, and who, in a gathering of friends, becomes the echo of malevolent words which do injury to some good work or taint the reputation of some cleric? Oh, my dear, I do not believe a word of it myself, but this is what someone said about Father so-and-so. But are you, who repeat these remarks, aware that in thus converting these slanderous words into one stream, you become the echo of the slander of others? I judge your action very severely, and I tremble when I find you piously posing before the holy table on the next morning. When a doctor visits a sick man, says a certain moralist, he asks to see his tongue. That organ gives him a certain indication as to the general health of the sick man. So, from a spiritual point of view, we can tell the condition of the soul by the tongue. My daughters, if you abandon yourselves to all the intemperances of the tongue, it is a positive sign that your souls are spiritually ill. If, on the contrary, you keep a strict watch over the tongue and prevent its excesses, rejoice. Your soul is spiritually healthy. Learn to judge yourselves by this rule. Generously sacrifice for God's sake every word, however trivial it may be, which might offend against the virtue of charity or cause injury to your neighbor. The homes of many who pretend to be Christians are often schools of slander, mockery, and disparagement. If an unbeliever were to assist at a repast in one of these families pretending to Christian etiquette and reputed to be practical Catholics, he would be astonished to find malignity where he looked for the full blossom of charity, that chosen flower of the Master. What a responsibility hangs over those mothers who tolerate these detestable practices, and who, instead of holding up a high ideal to their children, let them wallow in vulgar gossip and even encourage them in their deplorable propensity to criticize and defame everyone and everything. I conjure you, my daughters, to preserve a strict watch over your tongues and never to pronounce before your children one single word that is contrary to charity. Then only will you have the right to preach the horror of scandal to them. Moreover, in this matter, your example is the only preaching needed. You are the model for all the members of your family. Let this sentiment of your responsibility stimulate you to reject from your conversation all rash judgments, and every habit of criticism which your children might adopt unknown to you. St. Augustine had these words posted in his refectory, "Speak not ill of the absent." This motto proved that he was not only a saint, but also a man of honor. My daughters, you will do well to post up this motto in your homes, at least in practice. You yourself should see that your family lives up to it. Your voice, with a sweet firmness, should remind those who are prone to forget that with you and before you, no evil must be spoken of the absent. Chapter 10, Spiritual Imperfection. This chapter is addressed to those whose ambition it is to avoid not only venial sin committed with deliberate intent, but all imperfection. The meaning of certain words in our language stands out clear when they are more clearly defined. The word imperfection is of these. Many persons undertake to combat all their imperfections who have only a vague idea as to just what an imperfection really is. I desire to aid my readers to form a correct notion of spiritual imperfection which will enable them to use this word in its true sense. First of all, let us take care not to confound imperfection with sin. This confusion of terms is very often made in ordinary conversation. Of a light slander or a trivial lie it is said, "This is only an imperfection." Now, that is not true. Each of these acts is a violation of one of God's commandments and therefore a sin. The triviality of the violation attenuates the gravity of the fault committed, but does not change the character which classes this act in the category of sins. Therefore, we must never apply the term imperfection either to venial sin or the habit of this sin, however trivial the sin itself may be. Here then is a first conclusion. Imperfection can exist only in a free act, an act not regulated by precept. Now indeed we see that imperfection is clearly distinct from sin. This brings us to the most delicate part of our task, that is, to determine the especial condition that taints with imperfection an act which falls under no law. This condition is the lack of cooperation with grace. Yesterday, in passing by some poor man, I heard no interior voice pressing me to give him aid. By not giving this man an alms, did I commit an imperfection? Not at all. Since I was not solicited by grace, I could not have been unfaithful to it. Today, on the contrary, I feel inclined to give the same man an alms. Now, if I refuse to perform the act which grace demanded of me, I am guilty of an imperfection. If I have not given as much as grace demanded of me, I must know that I am guilty of imperfection in the measure in which I have been unwilling to respond to the divine appeal. We have now, it seems to me, the elements sufficient to formulate a good definition of imperfection. We can call it a partial or a total lack of cooperation with grace in a free act. But does this definition solve all the problems which may arise in actual life? No, certainly not. But for the present we have an adequate idea of the word imperfection, and it is no longer to be feared that in theory at least we will create any serious confusion. The line that separates imperfection from sin is so easy to trace that we can follow it without the least effort when a hypothetical case is in question. On the other hand, when the case is concrete and takes on the appearance of a case of conscience, which has to be settled, our task is not so simple. Occasionally, it is true, there is no room for doubt. The prompting of grace has been so distinctly felt and the resistance to it so clearly accentuated that imperfection is evident. But very often the problem is not so simple. Difficulties well nigh inextricable present themselves. Vainly do we strive with a most scrupulous effort to comprehend the case at hand. In vain do we force ourselves with the most admirable loyalty to repeated and profound examinations of conscience. Even these do not always solve the case. A multitude of thoughts, sentiments, and volitions often escape us entirely. Moreover, there is a goodly number of interior acts, the morality of which we cannot determine precisely, and thus we are forced to remain in a semi-obscurity. However, it seems to me that it is not quite impossible to come to a practical decision as to whether this or that act has been tainted by imperfection. Why not apply the same rule that we use when we doubt whether we have resisted a temptation to the best of our ability? How do we dispel a doubt in this case? by remembering that we are not habitually disposed to offend God by mortal sin. This remembrance suffices to restore peace to our souls. Why not make use of a like remembrance to settle the uncertainty in the case of imperfection? If we are habitually disposed to follow the inspirations of grace, have we not the right to decide the doubtful case in our favor? Conceived under the form which I have described, imperfection becomes something relative. Something may be an imperfection for me, but not for you, because I may have been prompted by grace and you may not. Because of my failure to perform the act which grace demanded of me, I am guilty of an imperfection, while you are guilty of no imperfection by not performing the same act. There was no question of cooperation on your part because you were not prompted by grace. Doubtless this explains why theologians and ascetic writers in treating of imperfection assume a reserve which seems almost excessive. As they are profuse with details when it is a question of cataloguing sins, so they are cautious when cataloguing imperfections. I foresee a difficulty which is springing up in your minds, my daughters. You are saying to yourselves, according to the teaching of St. Thomas and the generality of theologians, no act can be called indifferent. Every act is either meritorious or sinful. Now, an imperfect act is not a sin. Must we then number it among the meritorious acts? Assuredly, I answer, an act, although it be imperfect, can possess a certain merit. Let us take, for example, not one of those intricate cases of conscience which serve to display the subtlety of the casuist, but a very ordinary case. Suppose that after giving a few pennies to some poor man, I feel grace prompting me to give 5 pennies more. After taking thought, I decide to give him only 3. Evidently, there has been a resistance to grace on my part, and therefore I have become guilty of imperfection. What will be the value of my act? The sane casuist and my good sense respond that this act has not been as meritorious as it might have been, and I have voluntarily deprived myself of a degree of glory in heaven. But since I have violated no precept, I have committed no sin. The moral value of my act, despite the imperfection which taints it, has not been essentially impaired. A piece of money has value despite the tarnish that has gathered on it. Now the advocates of the opposite opinion will make this discouraging assertion. An act is meritorious only when it has all the perfection of which it is capable. To this I answer, in that case, who could acquire merit? I shall not insist on the immense advantages which will accrue from a generous cooperation with the movements of grace. This practice, earnestly continued for 3 months, says Pierre Pegmeyer, will create an admirable change in you. Your whole interior will be transformed by it. I hear another question proposed to me by one who has resolved to cooperate with the promptings of grace. How, she asks, can I distinguish the movements of grace from those of nature? Confusion is so easy. How can I know whether or not there has been a resistance to grace and consequently an imperfection? Let me respond by recalling the rules laid down by the saints to aid us in distinguishing the inspirations of grace from those of nature. First rule: all inspirations which stimulate us to flee from evil and repress evil inclinations bear the mark of God. This is evident. The Spirit of God is a spirit of holiness. It should inspire us to suppress all evil. I judge of the presence of the Holy Spirit, says St. Bernard, by certain movements of the heart, which prompt me to flee from evil and to struggle against my evil propensities. Second rule: all those inspirations which excite us to practice one of the virtues of Jesus Christ are of divine origin. Whenever, says St. Bernard, you feel in your heart a salutary movement which stimulates you to mortification of the body, humility of heart, the preservation of purity, the love of your neighbor, or some other virtue, do not hesitate to believe that the Holy Spirit is acting in you. Third rule: the Spirit of God is a spirit of obedience and submission to superiors. Therefore, we must distrust at once every movement which impels us to judge against the judgment and will of our superiors. Fourth rule: all inspirations, all interior movements come from God if humility precedes, accompanies, and follows them. This rule is given us by Gerson. Let us condemn with St. Bernard, whom we should take as our guide in this matter, every interior movement which inclines us first to desire to be visited by extraordinary graces and virtues, by visions, revelations, and other exceptional favors. Second, to disdain the practice of those virtues suited to our state. Third, to vainglory. Fourth, to a scorn for our neighbor. Fifth, to a longing for the admiration of others. Fifth rule. The Spirit of God is a spirit of discretion. The Spirit of God, says Père Dupont, exacts from us only the practice of ordinary virtues, not those beyond our powers. Every desire for devotions, penances, and practices which conflict with the duties of our state of life is to be regarded with suspicion. The same must be said of all those mortifications which endanger the health, or result in a serious weakening of the body. These are some of the rules which can aid us to distinguish the movements of grace from those of nature. Those of my readers who desire a further development on this subject will do well to consult the excellent work of Père Pegmeier, Troy Pa Don L'Amour de Dieu. Part Third, The Means Par Excellence. Chapter One, The Holy Mass. My daughters, I have now come to that part of my work which is dearest to my heart. If I succeed in instilling in you a deep love for the Eucharist, if I can induce you to enter into the most intimate relations with Jesus in the Sacred Host, then the purpose of this book will be attained. Under the guidance of the heart of Jesus, you will soon realize the ideal of the truly Christian woman. First, let me say a few words concerning assistance at Mass every day or several times a week. Is this practice familiar to all mothers without exception? No. There are some obliged to remain at home on account of their household duties or the care of their children. Many mothers would like to make a truce every morning with their accustomed duties and come for a half an hour to the church, but they cannot. Many mothers heartily regret that they are bound to this duty or that duty, since it renders them unable to assist at Mass. I know some pious mothers who unite their intentions with those of the priest, and for want of sacramental communion, they make a spiritual communion. Surely God takes their good will into consideration. The pain they experience because of their inability to assist at Mass, since they offer it up to God, brings them very special graces. It would be a great injustice to number these mothers among the lukewarm. But are there not some mothers who, by making a little sacrifice, could assist at Mass every day, or at least several times a week? Yes, if they would rise a little earlier in the morning, they could easily do so. Now, I am not demanding heroism. I plead the cause of your dignity, mothers of families, and I ask you not to be so great a slave to laziness as to refuse to sacrifice 1 hour of sleep a few mornings in the week. I put little faith in those headaches which you sometimes advance as an excuse. Is it not strange you are always suffering from a headache when it is a question of assisting at Mass, but you never complain of a headache when it is a question of some pleasure or self-indulgence? Still less do I accept the lack of time as an excuse, for I dare to affirm that in assisting at Mass you gain time. You place in the soul a principle of order and energy, the beneficent influence of which pervades the entire day. You will work better and produce more fruit. That half hour which you give to God each morning, far from being lost, will be the time best employed during the day. It will incite you to renounce useless reading. It will stimulate you to refrain from gossiping and help you to cut short your purely conventional visits